You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
I know this is the right thing to do, Dad, because I would die for this kid, just so he wouldn't have to feel 1 ounce of sadness.
That's why you're here right now, to protect me, to be scared for me.
To be a good father. And that's exactly what I'm gonna be.
Hello, Dad? Yeah, I just wanted to say I love you.
Hi, Mom. Could you put down the phone for a sec?
This front kind to Papa.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch?
I'd like that.
Tom Haverstraw. Over there is Ben Aronson. What's up, Ben?
What's up, everybody?
We decided to do part two with Pablo Torre today. Our guest is Ethan Strauss from the Burbs outside of Oakland, East Bay.
Yeah, I think they call it the La Mirinda area is what they say now.
Is that two words?
It's combining of a bunch of different towns, but I'm pretending like I'm a big deal. I'm not as comfortable telling people what specific town I live in versus when I was in Oakland because it's a large enough city. Gotcha. I'm not comfortable pegging it to one town. So I just give the region, La Mirinda.
Okay.
No stalkers up here.
Well, we are really excited to have you on the pod. And I know people out there with the conspiracy theory are going to think that this is just Pablo part two because everyone thinks that you and Pablo sound alike. So it is suspicious, Ben, that we have Pablo and then right after that, Ethan Strauss.
I think he is the fraud in this whole thing because when you really think about it, it makes no sense for us to have similar voices. He is from New York. I'm from San Diego. And I don't think anybody would say that Pablo has a New York accent. So who's really pulling a fast one here? You know, Amin from New York. New York accent. Waz from New York. New York accent. Pablo from New York. What the hell is that? What the hell is that? People would think he's from where I'm from.
You don't have a typical Southern California accent.
I don't. I did, but I don't. I really did. And I think in this country there are a bunch of accents that are pronounced. Pardon the pun, but they're not famous. You know, New York famous, Boston famous, Pittsburgh to a certain extent. But you have these other ones, and I definitely grew up talking a certain way that I noticed when I went to college that other people didn't talk like. And then when I would go home, I would sound more like it. And so there's definitely a regional sound that I have shed. So maybe I'm the fraud.
So
in the end,
when Boston, my dad is from the Boston area. And so when everyone finds out he's from Boston, like, oh, we go to have a yacht and go park the car. What is the tell from when you're from the San Diego area?
Well, first of all, I feel like the tell for Boston is not the dropping of the R, even though some of that exists. The tell for a New England accent that I try to identify in my nerdy way when I'm watching TV and I hear an actor use a certain phrase and I'll go to my wife, like, oh, I know where he's from, and she won't care at all, but I'll look it up on IMDb and feel triumphant. With Boston, it's how you pronounce that O sound specifically you look for the word not. If they're saying not, like, yeah. that right there is a New England.
It's like
spell.
A U. It's like, a U O T. Yeah. Like A U O T.
A U G H T or something like that.
That's a really easy way to peg the accent to that particular region of the country. It might not be Boston, but it's definitely New England. And I don't think you're going to find that anywhere else. I think that's a very quick and dirty way. I don't know if there's a quick and dirty way for San Diego. I remember in the Accent Tag archive that some university compiled where everybody reads the same paragraph, they had a guy from San Diego, and it's just a guy reading a list of grocery items. And at some point, the San Diego guy said, six snow pays for snow pays. Six snow pays. There's
pays.
You know, there's the SNL guys and Kyle Mooney. I almost want to look it up because I can't remember what it was called, but they did a parody of San Diego people, and it was kind of an internet viral.
Wait, hit. Are those the Californians?
That was brilliant too.
Yeah. Not that. I'm trying to remember what it was called, because it was not on SNL. It involved SNL people. Jonah Hill was involved in it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. This is deep cut.
While you're looking that up.
Yeah.
I will say this. The ironic thing about the Boston thing is the biggest hater in the world on Boston accents is Bill Simmons.
Yeah.
And yet, he is the worst at doing one. He will try to like tell you how somebody is doing it wrong by himself doing it awfully. And then Russillo will be sitting right there and be like, actually, let hold my beer. Let me show you how this is done.
It's not how it's done. So it's Inside SoCal is the Kyle Mooney. I mean, you watch that. If you watch that, and yeah, it's comedy, but it's this is how I grew up. This is how everybody sounded. This is how everybody acted. This is how everybody was. It is completely dead on Inside SoCal. The fashion, just the whole thing. And it's such a strange culture. I'm trying to be a little restrained because I'm going to sound snooty and like I've disavowed my past. But it's not – San Diego, it's not a – it's – how do I say it? It's not the most intellectual of towns. Everybody's there to just have a good time. And surfing is not the most intellectual of pursuits.
A bunch of beach bums? Is that it?
Yeah. I have friends who are big time surfers and they're smart. But the thing about surfing is it's addictive, uncommonly addictive. And you spend all this time out on the water. And when you're spending all this time out in the water, you're collecting you're collecting as much information about the world as the fish are. So it's not a town that is really – San Diego feels like an island that's not an island is what I would say. You don't totally know what's going on out there. You're drinking your margaritas. You're surfing, and whatever's happening out there in the world, it's the opposite of that feeling of – when you're in New York and you know that you're at the nerve center of the country, which might have shifted to the Bay Area, but that's a different topic. San Diego, I don't know how you would identify it. I just know what I sounded like. I know what I would sound like if I got to drinking a little bit, and I shed it somehow. I don't know why, but I could probably start talking like it. And this is actually – I'm not joking. This is how I sounded when I was growing up. This is more so how I talked. It's a little bit of a monotone, a little bit of an upspeak, a little bit of gravel. And I can't identify a particular word, but this is how it sounds.
Well, somehow from another human with not the deepest voice, your pitch went up with your old accent. Which, by the way, is unbelievable because, again, I'm making fun of myself. But every now and then I will hear my voice and I will go, well, I'm never going to speak like that again. I'm never going to say that word.
So did you consciously change your voice? What happened there?
Oh, no. Listen to me. This is not bass or baritone. Sound, but you just, I think as you get older, you hear things in your voice, whether it's an accent, a tone, you know, a speech impediment, whatever. And you're like, not that you're trying to fix your voice. I'm not doing that Theranos woman, like, you know, but I think you do actively try to fix things.
When I was in college, I did an acting class and the instructor would like do voice exercises with you before we got into acting. And she'd be like, now try to talk out of your forehead. And I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, try to talk out of your forehead. And I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. She's like, just try it. And you instinctively, you tense up and you go a little bit higher for whatever reason. You like your it goes even higher. And if you want to talk out of your stomach, you just like, you just naturally start talking deeper. And the idea is when you get really nervous and really tense, you start to raise your, you just go up an octave. And so it reminded me of when I used to do the big number videos and I was starting out and I was really nervous. I went into a tenor from a baritone. Be like, LeBron James, when he is out there on the floor, his PER next to Kyrie Irving is 37.5. And I remember we were at one of those ESPN like summits, Ethan. And I remember Brian Windhorst sitting next to me. He's like, they played the big number in one of the meetings. And Brian just turns to me. He's like, did you like inhale a balloon right before you did that? I was like, no.
It's hard. Sorry. When you got that energy. I'm also thinking about other accent tags. Another one for Pittsburgh. I don't know if the word moment comes up a lot, but any word that sounds like that. Pat McAfee, is that how to pronounce that guy's name? That one man media empire who's always interviewing Aaron Rodgers. That guy is clearly Pittsburgh area because I was watching him interview Rodgers and he asked about a moment, but he said moment. And that one right there. Yeah.
Well, so listen, I think this is obviously the transition point. Anybody would
Pick also up on. It's the transition point because I clearly didn't listen to Tom. Tom told a story and I just went exactly to my accents again. And then I just interrupted you. I'm doing a bang up job.
Called you out as you being at the meeting a part of my story. You just totally blew me off.
I did. Because I love thinking about accents. I couldn't stop thinking about accents.
You know what it is? It is, and I think I actually can let me attempt to transition this. Because I think what happened is Ethan, by moving from the city to the suburbs, has gone into that self-involved bubble. Because when you're in the city, you have to engage with people on a daily basis. You got to talk to people. But you now being in the suburbs, you're that guy who talks to his neighbor and kind of never acknowledges that his neighbor has said anything in return. Pretty much like every State Farm commercial, right? That's what you've become. But on that note, you know, we're really interested in speaking to you because ironically, I do think that having Pablo, New Yorker, which I can relate to, but Northeasterner, which Tom can relate to, it is going to be interesting to talk to somebody from Southern California. I have a lot of family from there. And I think parental relationships, family relationships are just very different in California. And I think you started to allude to it with like the surfing thing, with the hanging out thing. San Diego is not a cheap place to live, right? So in theory, a lot of the families who have settled there are really wealthy and or successful, and the kids somehow end up being, you know, very different. You know, so, you know, Tom, I had texted you. I was like, oh, Tom, I want to let you kind of lead this interview. And now I'm taking the
you
first
just
question.
You stole the ball and I did. Driving in the I hoop, did. Ready to dunk it. Let's see if Ethan
I did.
Finishes the
alley. It's culturally very different. From up here in the Bay Area, less competitive. And you do have, at least where I grew up, more old money. Old money is a thing, especially in La Jolla, of people who have inheritances and or maybe they're wealthy, but they're not wealthy in these highly competitive fields. And a lot of their kids go on to go to great schools and do great things. And then other kids just become beach bums. Let's be real about it. They become ne'er-do-wells. There was even a dateline on a group of La Jolla kids who ended up beating one of their friends to death, not to take a morbid turn. But they and I knew all of them. I went to high school with all of them. And it was really a tragedy, but they had become these guys who just hung out at the beach into adulthood after high school, and you know, sold coke and did all that, and it all sort of spun out. And so with surf culture especially, there's a dark underbelly to it where it's associated as this happy-go-lucky thing in the broader culture. I think people who didn't grow up around surfing project a lot onto it.
I've heard from people. I'm waiting for the counter to that, because I'm like, that is exactly how I envision surfers to be, is just like basically water hippies.
Yeah, yeah. You've got the it's like the Zoolander scene where they're going to the gas station. Maybe that's a good parable for the whole thing, because it sometimes just goes – it just goes wrong. And it's interesting. It's hard to explain.
What's the dark underbelly part of it?
Just a lot of addiction. I mean, you're talking about people who have made this very interesting choice in many cases. Well, there are people who balance it with a functional life. There are other people who go in the way you see with ski bums. I've noticed it with rock climbing culture, which is more around the Bay Area, where they just live for this thing that doesn't necessarily go anywhere but is highly addictive. And then that comes along with other addictions, and you're sort of dropping out of life in a way.
Right, right.
So my little cousin is just that. He's not even that little anymore. He's just about 30, but he – you know, is an LA lifeguard in Venice Beach. He was a surf bum, and he considers himself a waterman. And it does kind of go back and forth between this, hey, we're spiritual, we're green, sustainable, outdoors people. I live for the moment, man, with this other side of it, which is like irresponsibility and, you know, and kind of a lack of traditional work ethic. And that actually makes me wonder, you know, for you growing up, with both of those things around you, what was your relationship like with your parents to kind of keep you, I don't want to say guided on the right path, but like clearly, you know, you gained a high value for education, for intellect. So I'm just curious, like, you know, how that grew up with you and your parents in that way.
Well, what helped was their negligence in recreational activities. I never learned how to do the cool things. And that was so key to social status as a kid where I grew up. You know, you weren't going to be cool in many cases. I mean, you could, but it helped a lot if you could skate, if you could surf, if you could snowboard. I mean, that was the key to everything. That's like being a jock where I'm from. And so when I hear people say to me, because I've met people, they find out where I'm from. And it's such a beach community, around La Jolla and all of that. In Tom Wolfe's book, he actually, I think, had this chapter that is just based in Windansea, this famous beach, and the whole culture around it. And so people go like, oh man, I would have been surfing all the time. And I go, I don't think you understand. It's almost like saying if you meet somebody from Texas and you go like, oh, I would have been on the football team. I would have played free safety. Like, you don't understand that this is kind of a very jockish culture that you've got to be good enough. And if you're not good enough, you probably can't participate. At Windansea Beach, if you come in from out of town, you've got an out-of-state license plate, you get a brick put through your fucking window.
What?
I mean, yeah, it's very territorial. Surfing's very territorial. There's a finite amount of space. Your enjoyment of it is positively correlated to how much space you have. And so it's literal turf only. Yeah, it's literal turf war. It's locals only. In some ways, culturally, Point Break might be a good representation when we talk about the dark underbelly. I'm not saying that the people I grew up around were robbing banks, but some of that is real. And so I think in a way I was helped by just having nerdy parents who never, you know, I knew guys growing up. I had friends where their dad taught them how to surf. My dad didn't know how to surf. He didn't teach me how to surf. I don't really know how to surf. You know, he actually taught me how to play basketball because he liked basketball and Little League and stuff like that. You know, my mom wasn't in any of the stuff. And I remember I wanted a skateboard when I was a kid. And I begged for it, and she got me it was this brand called Nash, and it was the nerdy, dorky skateboard that you wouldn't be caught dead with.
It's like showing up instead of the Jordans or the Nikes, you show up with like Spaldings.
Exactly, exactly. And when I got it, it's so ungrateful, but I was just – I was old enough at that point. I knew it was like, I can't be seen with this. I can't use it. And so I didn't really learn how to skate. At some point I think my dad was nice enough to give me rollerblades, but rollerblading for whatever reason was highly stigmatized. I remember in middle school, every now and again, I would be walking home from school and I would hear somebody scream out, "Blader!" And these kids would just run after the kid who was rollerblading and kick his ass. So that was a pretty good indication that that wasn't the thing to do either.
Yeah,
yeah, that wasn't the thing to do either. So I think one of the reasons that I got more into reading and did everything else is just that nobody showed me the way, and I'm an only child. So there's just not a lot of ways to to learn how to do things at a certain age beyond your parents. So yeah, that's probably, and I should be clear, I'm stereotyping in many ways. I went to Cal with a friend of mine who's big time surfer. And you know, whenever he goes to the doctor's office, the doctor knows he's a surfer because you got the sand in your ears when they do the thing. And like, people can balance it, but I'm just sort of speaking to the general kind of the general culture of it down there, because a lot of it revolves around it. I mean, a lot of San Diego, especially in the beach communities, a lot of the culture revolves around the beach. And I wasn't any good at beach things, so I was a bit of an outsider in that way.
Well, this is the Dad Pod, and I like that we spent the first 15, 20 minutes about your upbringing and your regional intellect. And I think the only person who is more into accents than you, Ethan, is Kevin Arnovitz, because he nerds out on that stuff more than anyone I know. But it kind of gives people a window into, you know, how you grew up versus how you're bringing up your son. Aren't raising your son in La Jolla. Why is that?
Well, there's no NBA team in San Diego. So that's one thing. Secondarily, I don't go back often. I think that I was very fortunate to grow up where I grew up. It was strange in a way. When I tell people that I grew up in La Jolla, I think they think that I grew up in this like extravagantly wealthy, because it's a wealthy community. It's a community that's associated with wealth. I remember name drop Steph Curry was giving me shit and was saying like, "Oh, did you, was it like mimosas every day, you know, on the yacht? You know, was it that growing up?" And it wasn't. My mom, I guess, inherited her house from her mom. It's kind of a very standard house. It was on the border of La Jolla. I was lucky. She was a librarian. She became a branch manager. And my dad was a school administrator. They were divorced. I'm fortunate. Like I wasn't going hungry, but it wasn't like living in the lap of luxury, but it did give a window into it. I feel like I understand how to move around rich people and old money just from having been there. And I look back on it with some fondness. It's a very strange place culturally. And I don't think that I'm avoiding it. I think if somebody said to me that I could live there and that would be your life and you're going to make enough money and be comfortable, I would accept it. But I was bored there and I was desperate to get out.
Yeah.
I wanted to leave. I really wanted to leave. And maybe in a pretentious way, maybe I was thinking like, I'm going to go to Berkeley and everybody's going to be so much more interesting than these idiots I'm surrounded by. And, you know, maybe it was that kind of thing. But it just felt sheltered, man. It just felt like there's a big world out there and you're not experiencing it. And I still feel that when I return. I still feel like it feels almost a little like going to Hawaii, which is really nice, but you don't know what's going on everywhere else. And I can't stand that.
You made the move literally to the burbs.
Yeah.
And this is a big move for Mr. Golden State Warriors beat writer, Oakland guy. And as soon as they leave Oakland, you get out of Oakland and you go into the burbs. So walk me through the decision to do that. And, how are you liking it so far?
Yeah, I'd been wanting to do it for a while. I was the one who was advocating it. Allie is cooler than me, so she was liking the city more. But my mom, my mom moved from San Diego up to the East Bay when I started going to college up here, and she's in Concord. So I wanted to be closer to where she was at, and I wanted more space. And I had reached the conclusion after a while that I had aged out of the city, that I wasn't really enjoying – I think this happens to us, and I'm just looking at our millennial generation where – we all go out to the city. Why do we do that? Well, we're young, and frankly, everybody's looking to date people, and especially pre-Tinder and all that. So the only place to do that, especially back then, it's the bar scene and everything else in cities. And then you start living in the city, and then it's almost – it's just inertia. And also the city was having a really good run of it. You know, cool things were happening, wine bars, tea bars popping up and whatnot. But at a certain point, I just said to myself, I'm not really getting a whole lot out of this. I'm too old now, and we have the kid. This idea of like, why am I in Oakland to appreciate the theater? Like, no, I'm watching the same shit on Netflix everybody else is watching. You know, yeah, there are a lot of cool things. There are a lot of beer gardens and whatnot. I'm not doing any of that. I don't have the opportunity to do it. So I would rather have a backyard. I would rather just, you know, have quiet, and I would rather have all that stuff. So, you know, eventually, you know, the move was made, and I don't regret it. I don't know how it works for everybody else. I think we say suburbs and we're generalizing, but at least in the East Bay, I think the East Bay Hills are the most underrated, talking about like sports, underrated top five, just in terms of beauty and scenery in the country. They're not in any songs I'm aware of. There's no country roads about the East Bay Hills, but I have just
East Bay Hills, take me home to a hill.
Been obsessed with it ever since I came back from living in New York and took the BART on out to see my mom. And I just hadn't seen any greenery because I was living in Brooklyn in the winter. And I just look in these green hills. It looks like Scotland in the winter to springtime out in the East Bay. And I just love it out here. And if it's a secret, then it's a secret. But I think it's awesome.
You know, Prim and I are going through this, and you know, you have a kid, and you're right. You stop doing a lot of the things that are the reason to be in a city, you know? Yeah. But one of the things that keeps a lot of people, especially if you become successful in the city, is convenience, right? Because most people are commuting. And I think the advantage that you have is your job. Like, you don't need to go into an office every day, right? So like living in the suburbs doesn't mean that you don't get to see your kid at all every day. And yeah. Prim and I, for the most part, have a similar thing. Like, I don't have to be in the office every day pre-COVID, and now post-COVID, definitely not every day. And so we look at that stuff. But one of the other things that I'm not going to lie, like we thought a lot about, is as you raise a kid in the city versus the suburbs, the influences and opportunity to be influenced are just different, right? Mm. And now I'm not saying city kids are bad. They just grow up faster. My friends who like grew up in New York City, they were just like adults earlier. And I don't necessarily want that, those things to, even though I see advantages to it, that's cool. Pablo talked about it. He loves the idea of being raised in the city. For me, it's just like, that's a whole set of experiences that I personally don't want for my kid at 9, 10, 11, 12.
It's like the outside of the city, there's almost a conspiracy to preserve childhood. And to have this to do that collectively. And the city is kind of a childless place in many ways, increasingly. And those mores, I think, are reflected in the management of it. And that's the biggest growing cohort. I think I read an Atlantic article on it, is people without kids are the largest growing population in cities. That was pre-pandemic, so who the hell knows? I mean, that's this other subplot, is that my daycare's in the city, not the city San Francisco, but I'm talking East Bay, and it's like something died in it. It's like it's grim right now, and I think that when a vaccine is found, hopefully everything comes roaring back. But it's like the kind of energy that the city is thriving on. I don't know how it is out in New York, but it seems like it's kind of gone. And so Ben has a great point about how you can't really protect your kid from anything, but there's this other thing happening where the city is just not as good a bet right now. And I don't think anybody knows if that's a temporary situation or if that's long term.
What about space?
Yeah, you get more space. I mean, that's it's expensive. I mean, Bay Area is expensive. I mean, I window shop all the time. I've been talking to Amin for years about Phoenix, because you look out in Phoenix and it's just – it's amazing what you can get versus what you can get here. But on a relative basis, price per square foot, yeah, it seems like if you're not in those direct Silicon Valley suburbs – you get a better deal out in the La Mirinda area. Now, there is this thing though that I've noticed.
Is that Lafayette in there?
Yeah, it's La Mirinda for Lafayette. You know, Moraga, Arinda. So it's that combination.
And this segment is brought to you by Zillow. So thank you, Zillow, for sponsoring our real estate dad pod section. Well, back to you, Ethan.
Yeah, what I've noticed though is that it's more housing bubble proof in the city. The city is more housing bubble proof. And I think my theory on that is it's about density and it's about supply and demand. Because if you look at what happened after the 08 bubble and you look at San Francisco and Berkeley, which are the most dense cities in the Bay Area, they had a dip, but they bounced back really quickly and their dip was way less so than what La Mirinda experienced. Certainly, I mean, Concord just saw their house price average exceed what it was pre-bubble, you know, 2007. So those exurbs really get hit hard. So I think you get a better deal out in the suburbs, price per square foot. But the city traditionally, I think, has been more housing bubble burst resilient, just because they're never going to build new houses in Berkeley.
Where does
they build as many as they can?
Where does Radio Ethan commute in from? Because I know his radio show is in Concord. Is he living in Concord or is he coming in from somewhere else?
That's a great question. I would say that he lives in Concord. I would say that. I've never really thought about where he might commute from. It would be funny if he commuted from Sacramento to Concord. it'd be such a weird reverse commute, but I think it's easy to just say that he lives in Concord.
Does Radio Ethan have an opinion about city life versus burb life?
I see where you're taking me. I see what's going on. I'm not really there mentally. I'm like a prima donna. I haven't done radio Ethan. Look, everybody knows the city is a cesspool, folks. It is disgusting. I've been there before. Crime is legal. It's allowed. Commit whatever crime you want. Why would you want to be somewhere where it was allowed to have crime committed? If you're in the suburbs, you're away from the rabble, you're away from the riffraff, you don't have to pretend that bums are citizens who should be afforded space. It's a paradise, folks, a utopia.
It's great.
By the way, I lived in Concord for part of the summer while I was making the house transition, so it was interesting living in Concord as an exurb. I would say Concord is exurb. I wouldn't say suburb.
All right, so what is the thing that you love about and I'm just generalizing burbs here. What is something you thought you'd hate about the burb life but you secretly love?
So it's such a tough question to answer because I didn't think I would hate anything. I was ready. I think it was more so Allie. I think it was more so Allie who wasn't totally ready and she was worried. And it's so surreal to make this move at this particular time because – I think she was worried about how stuck up people would be, and we haven't really encountered that, but we're also not really fully integrated into the community because of the whole pandemic situation. So everybody's very friendly on this superficial level, and we can see all these friendships that might happen, but they just can't pass the threshold because nobody is inviting people into their house. That's not happening. So we come away from it thinking, man, everybody's really nice. But maybe if we knew people on a deeper level or were in some sort of community function and saw how competitive people are. I also think there's a degree of projection and coping because, again, when I was growing up in La Jolla, I would just hear things about what people were like there. And it didn't necessarily match my experience of all the people I knew. So I think there is this idea of, oh, the people out there, they're so stuck up and yada, 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 yada. And no, they're pretty nice. You know, maybe there's some of that, but people have been nicer. I would say this. We were afraid of how cold people might be. And if anything, people were way colder where we were living. You know, with the exception of a couple neighbors of ours who we really like a lot back in Oakland. And people have been very friendly here. Very friendly.
You've been to my house before, so you know generally what I'm talking about. On my street, it's a neighborhood kind of like, you know, suburban neighborhood, but it's kind of a city suburb because you're like right outside the city.
It's very nice.
But there's a cul-de-sac right by my house where we've kind of, instead of going to people's houses and hanging out for dinner, you kind of go at like the 5 o'clock, right before dinner time, you go and you take your kid bike riding and they just ride around in circles in this cul-de-sac. And it's just this long straightaway, kind of like an airport runway where they just like these 3-year-olds just all ride their bikes. And that is kind of the only like socializing we get to do is just all the parents just kind of socially distant, just like stand around and talk, like talking across the street from each other. But I'm using this as a way to preach to the audience. If you have a 2-year-old, a 1-year-old, and you want to teach your kid how to ride a bike, do not do the whole training wheels thing. Do not. Get a balance bike. Balance bikes are the goat. Balance bikes, I never knew what they were when we were growing up. Did anyone have a balance bike when we were growing up?
I still don't know what it is.
No, but I remember them from the intro to the movie Rad. I don't know if you remember that movie. It was about BMX bike riding in the 80s. It's got some of the same music from Karate Kid in it. This is me being older than all of you. We just got Duke for his second birthday, the balance bike, the Strider. But Ethan, it's pretty much a bike without pedals and no training wheels. And they get used to kind of like kicking themselves and then picking their feet up so that they kind of balance.
I'm jealous you guys are on flat land. I'm on a hill. I don't know when it's ever going to happen.
That's better. You just tell them pick up their feet.
Yeah.
Push Asher down a hill.
And you don't need a pedal. Like, you're just gone.
It'll be like Kramer in the rickshaw. Or sorry, it was Newman in the rickshaw.
It's so much easier. We had Madeline. We got her a balance bike, and she would just balance bike her way around town. And then someone had told us, like, when you go make the switch to riding a bike, you just skip over the whole training wheels thing and they just pick it up like that. And 2 weekends ago, I got out a pedal bike. We had our next door neighbor lent us the pedal bike for their kid who's outgrown it. And we went out and it was like within 35 minutes on a real pedal bike with no training wheels, she was riding around the whole town. And so that's my secret to getting your kid to ride a bike, pedal bike. She's 3 years old. She's riding bike. I don't think I rode a bike until I was like 6, 5 maybe. And that's the secret, is go with the balance bike. And you can't do it, I guess, in the hills, in the East Bay Hills there.
Yeah. Well, I should say, when you asked the question, what were you worried about that worked out okay? There is a worried about something where it worked out negatively a little bit, which is, and this is very suburban, if we want to talk about suburban culture, we did have a fence issue. We have had a fence issue with the neighbor. And I don't know
which is on your listener. Which is on your lot and which is on their lot. Are you saying, well, or yeah, the type of fence it was unappealing to the neighbor?
Or did you have a Wilson-esque neighbor that is just constantly peeping over the top of your fence?
No, it was – so it all started – we move in. The fence is dilapidated and our dog Otto escapes one night. And we don't even know if he escaped through the fence, but he comes back. And so my mother-in-law was just putting all this pressure on, you got to get the fence fixed. You got to get the fence fixed. You got to get the fence fixed. Like, okay. This is what we got to do. We got to get the fence fixed. So we get the fence fixed. I text our new neighbor about that we're doing this, and she seems like a little cold to the idea, but says as long as it's in the same area where the old fence was. So the fence gets replaced. She contends that it has been moved over some inches towards her lot, and now it would be impossible for her to repair her retaining wall if ever that came up. Not that there was any – urge to do it, but just, you know, in the event of the retaining wall cannot be fixed. I said, well, that happens, we could take out our part of the fence. And she didn't trust that and says, well, you might move, I don't know, this needs to be dealt with. So this was just a whole just suburban drama that played out. Eventually we had to spend a bunch of money to get a surveyor to be the mediator, to give the judgment. You're all nervous, you know. The surveyor sends the email, you're like, oh no, it's what, like, if, you know,
college then, acceptance letter, it's like, ooh, what's it gonna say?
where's the fence supposed to be? Where's the property line? And then boom, the fence was at least half a foot you know, within our property line. And you know, I kind of had this, I was kind of hoping, I was hoping that it would even be more so. It's like, oh, that's our retaining wall now. So that's how it's going to go. But it was just a whole drama, a whole finicky suburban drama of where is the line, and she's upset. How do we placate her? Do we want to have this bad relationship with our neighbor? We just moved here. This is mostly Allie, but she's a nice person who thinks about how other people think of her. I wouldn't have even gotten the surveyor, I don't think. I think I would have just been like, well, there's the fence. That's where it's going to be. But that was something that was definitely suburban culture that I didn't experience anything like that before.
It's funny, Ben, you mentioned the whole Wilson thing. I do this thing now with my neighbors where I know I can see my neighbor is out in their back deck, but I don't know if I should say hi or if that's intrusive, you know, like I don't want to be like, hey, I'm staring in your house and I noticed you were there.
I've got the same situation because I'm just looking down at my neighbor's backyard. I won't move. It's too much shit to move to give you a view. I mean, that will make it even weirder.
But I'm broadcasting into your backyard, if in case you didn't know.
Yeah, I'm just looking down into their backyard all the time. And it's a little weird, and it leads to awkward conversations for the back fence neighbor. But they're very nice people.
You know, I think as a New Yorker, I'm just used to the glass buildings and the windows, and like I've never been a blinds down type of guy.
You don't have the expectation that you can urinate in your backyard. Yeah, that's not an expectation in New York City. Well, that's the crazy thing about New York City is that really rich people live without so much space that in other places poorer people have. And I remember my friend's uncle was this real estate tycoon and lived in Manhattan. And even the really big, just incredibly expensive, tens of millions of dollar mansions in New York, they feel goofy. You know, you go in there, I go into his house, and it just feels like an Embassy Suites. It just feels like a hollowed out hotel. You're still in this kind of rectangle that you really couldn't see was any kind of special place from the outside. And so New York is such an odd place to me that way. I feel like if I was super rich, If I was super rich, I feel like New York wouldn't be it for me. Just with the way the expectation growing up in a more suburban setting, I don't think I could do it. It's just not I'm used to.
Speaking of rich, you have a business idea. We talked on the phone the other day about it. Asher, your son is playing sports a little bit, getting used to the sports. You're your dad now. You've turned into your dad, teaching your son basketball with the little Fisher Price hoop. But also, you know, you might take him out golfing, or you might take him out with a baseball bat. But when you take him out golfing, what have you noticed about Asher?
Yeah, so Asher likes to swing lefty, and I don't know if he's left-handed or right-handed, but that's how he likes to swing, whether it's the baseball bat or the little Fisher Price golf club. And this is quite the niche, but I can't be the only one going through this. I can't find any lefty golf clubs for a toddler. And you can find them if you jump up a level and if you're getting a legit golf set, which I can't trust him with. I can't get him a legit metal iron to swing around and knock vases off the table. But I just want a little plastic golf club for lefties, because he has a very nice swing, and it's so sad to watch him just hit the ball with the back face of the club.
It's so sad.
It's so sad. Although he doesn't care. I mean, it's not like he's trying to get good loft on it. It's not like he's trying to get a hole in one. But I would like it to be a proper golf swing with the plastic golf club. I cannot for the life of me. I look. I've considered trying to build one. It's amazing that this doesn't exist. Somebody could at least sell – somebody's got to be able to sell at least 50,000 of these suckers. There have to be enough people like me out there who would buy them to not be a huge business, but to be enough of a business, I would think.
Do you want to hear the company name that I came up with?
Tell me.
No Kid Lefty Behind.
Ah.
Well done. I feel like you and Harper have now – you've achieved that Harper level of punism.
I've got my black belt in punism, I feel like. No Child Lefty Behind or No Kid?
Well, No Child Left Behind. Yeah, No Child Left Behind is the George W. Bush initiative. But, you know, if you want to make it not so much a pun on that, maybe you want to go Kid perhaps.
Yeah.
I might call it Goofy Foot or something like that for just the lefty aspect of it.
Is that a snowboarding reference?
I think so. Or surf reference.
Surf reference? Oh yeah. I'm East Coasting myself that I don't know the surf terminology.
It's funny we're returning to it, but I'm just not big on the ocean. That's why I live in the hills. I'm not big on it, man. I'm not big on it. I think when I was a kid, because you would go to the beach all the time as a kid on field trips where I'm from, and they would always tell you how to do the stingray shuffle. Do you guys know about stingray shuffle?
No, yeah. I've been bitten by stung by a stingray. So. Yeah.
So it wouldn't have happened if you were doing the shuffle. The idea is if you're walking, you're going to step on a stingray and get stung. So if you shuffle like a penguin, it's not going to happen to you. And I just remember as a little kid, they're telling me this. I'm going, why the fuck are we going in there?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's not where we live. That's not our house. That's their house. It's the house of animals. What do we know? It's like animals that you can't see that are around your feet. Fuck that.
Do you know how to do the shark shift? No, I don't, because they're sharks. And I don't want to learn how to hang out with sharks.
Yeah. I don't want to have to, you know, if I walk regular, I'm going to get a searing pain shot through my foot.
Let's do the gorilla gallop. You know how to do the gorilla gallop? No, because I don't want to be around gorillas. Thanks.
There's a gator. What was it?
Oh man, I get like, now I'm getting all like PTSD over my stingray incident.
So, Asher's what, three now? Almost
he's
four?
He's getting to three. He's over the 2.5. He's over 2.5. So we're approaching three soon.
So my question for you, have you started thinking about proper, like how you want to introduce him to like sports as far as like teams and signing up? Is it something that you care about introducing him to?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, I do. I want to do that. I don't want to push him in any direction that he's against. He seems – I'm just giving an honest assessment. I don't think that it's biased. He seems like he's sporty. It seems like he's got a lot of energy. He's a little gremlin, and he needs to burn it off somehow. So this is going to be what it is. And at his age, it's not like he's incredibly fascinated by it. He likes to kick the soccer ball around a little bit. He likes to swing the golf club a little bit and the baseball bat, but it's not like it's going to obsess him for an hour or two, right? And so I just want him to get into whatever is going to hold his interest for the longest. Right now, he's too young for it, and it's hard to kind of plan any collective activity. But it is interesting. I mean, this is something that you're all probably going through. And I'm bouncing around. It's a bit of a digression, but maybe not. You do have to make these adjustments according to their awareness that you're not necessarily ready for. Out here in La Mirinda, everybody is scared of fires. That's all anybody talks about, especially around the fall. And it dominates life out here. And they have they pull out this red flag for when it's a red flag warning. When they wave the red flag, and they have indicators everywhere for when there's a high fire risk. They had a bill that they were arguing over passing called Measure R for giving more money to fight fires. And so Ali and I are just naturally talking fires all the time. And one day he tells us he's scared, and he's scared because of the fires, and he thinks the fires are coming. And it was this, oh shit, we've got to figure out. We now like. He's taking in way more than he's communicating, as I'm sure you guys have all experienced. And so I think around two and a half is the moment where you realize that you just can't talk freely around them anymore, and that they are absorbing things based on what you're doing around them. And now your life has fundamentally changed. And before, you were just kind of acting unwatched, and for the rest of your life, I think it's dawned on me that no, now I have to edit. You know, I have to edit everything. This is going to be how it is.
Well, we're coming up to the time, Ben. I think we should get to the dad or mom segment. Do you want to?
Yes.
Do you want to run through it?
Yeah. So here's what our plan is. Right. Well, we want to know. We're going to ask you a series of topics. And we want to know who is the person, right, that is taking over this subject matter. So, yeah. For instance, easy one, potty training, you or Ali?
Well, does it have to be binary where it's just you have to choose yes. one or the other?
Yes, Ali's not yes. listening to like, this. I've already muted
like
it.
Who's
for
really leading the way?
Ali.
All right. Disciplinarian.
Me.
Watching TV, who's the person who's like has the steadfast opinions on it?
Oh, her. Yeah, definitely her.
Who's reading All the right. bedtime story?
We are kind of out of the bedtime story phase, because he just wants story. He has story, and I think maybe because of my job, it just seems like that's – I'm better at just bullshitting and making up stories. he gets very demanding.
You heard it here first. Kevin Durant, you were right. Ethan made it all up. He had no sources. He's just good at making shit up.
Yeah, that's how it goes. He's demanding – he demands certain characters. He demands certain characters get their stories. And then I get annoyed because I feel like I'm being edited, and I feel like I've lost creative – I feel like I've lost creative control. Like, he likes the PJ Masks characters and has all these little PJ Masks toys, and he's like, story about Catboy, story about Catboy. I don't want to tell a story about Catboy.
Catboy died. He's dead.
I do have this fucked up sense of humor sometimes in my head, and I never do it. I never say it, but this is just my childish sense of humor. I sometimes think about how fucked up it would be to do something, and I giggle to myself. I just think of like, so Curious George, he was walking along, and a clown jumped out of the bushes and slit his throat. Now he's dead. I just think of like how messed up it would be if I don't, but I often just think
clown.
Of like,
oh.
And then the clown drank the blood, and you know, laughed at Curious George's family who were all crying. And the end.
I like that you start off this pod like not to get all morbid or anything. And then now we're talking about Curious George getting his throat slit.
By a clown, obviously.
By a clown, of course.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
So I want to dig in a little bit more. So do you is it a bedtime story? You don't read it? At a whim, he'll just be like, I want a story about X.
Well, so sometimes read the stories, and we were doing that. And now it just seems like – it became read stories, and then he got into bed, and then make up stories. Mm. And so now it seems like if you get you kind of want to get to the make up stories phase faster, just so I'm not being overworked over here where I'm reading and making things up. But then you worry about, is he missing something from not having the visual of us reading him the story?
And yeah. How does your mom, the librarian, feel about this?
She'd probably be in favor of the reading things. The other thing I try with him right now, this isn't before bed, but we're obviously not teaching him how to read at this age, but I want him to familiarize himself. So I like going to Google Translate and just typing words and having the robot read the words. And you know, I try to get him to type certain letters, but it definitely looks like the Kermit the Frog meme where he's just throwing his hands down on the keys like crazy. But he'll demand it again. He's like, Catboy, spell Catboy. I was like, okay, Catboy. So
do you make that up too? Thing. Did you just make up new spellings of Catboy?
Catboy, B-O-I, Catboy.
So. All right, so who makes the plans for the weekend?
Oh, her, definitely her. Men don't plan. Like, I don't know what we're bad. I'm generalizing. We're bad at planning. We're
so bad at it. So bad at it. I'm really bad at it. Hey, can you take Madeline to swim practice next Wednesday at 4:30? And I get like a huge panic. I'm like, I can't even think about that. 4:30 on a Wednesday. Are you kidding me? Like, how am I supposed to plan that far in advance? I don't know what's going to happen on Wednesday. Yeah. And she's like, can you just put it in the calendar and see if it works? I'm like, yeah, I could do that. Right, that's it. Well,
you also get she tries to get you to solidify your plans with your flaky caveman male friends and get things nailed down. It's like, we don't do that. It's just very vague that we're all gonna, you know, we're all gonna do this. Maybe go to the driving range, or we don't nail it down. We don't nail it down. We don't know.
Yeah, I went to my a buddy down the street. Was like, hey, I'm gonna do a campfire tonight if you want to come by. I'm like, yeah, sure, sounds good. And then Allison's like, hey, so when are you going to the campfire? I don't know, like anywhere from like 8 to like midnight, somewhere in there. And she's like, well, that doesn't help me. I was like, what?
And by the way, not going to the campfire is just as likely. It's because it's all on the table.
Yeah. I don't know what that difference is. I don't know if there's an evolutionary psych theory for it, but in my experience at least – she is so much more of a mastery of the logistics of our life than I do that it's not even – it's orders of magnitude.
All right. Kit, Asher's crying and you heard a boom in the other room. Who's running in there first?
Oh, her. And she relishes it. She likes being the nurturing hero, and he'll say beso to get a kiss, and she relishes that role. I relish being mean. I relish being a little bit mean. I kind of relish being disciplinarian a little bit.
It tough feels love daddy.
I feel a little like Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, where it's like, you need me on that wall. You know, you need me. You need me taking this privilege away or whatnot. It just feels necessary for the balance of the house.
Ethan's ordering Code Reds in bed at night. He's just telling Allie, listen, you can go in that room, fill up a sock with pennies.
I say things like, what is our leverage if we don't take this away? Like, what is our leverage? We only have this leverage.
All right. So Tom's favorite subject, poop diaper. Who's taking control?
That one's pretty down the middle. That one's pretty down the middle, I'd say. I think I'm less grossed out. I think she's more grossed out by poo.
So blowout happens. You're fine with taking care of it.
I mean, I don't love it, but it's just I don't know. It's micro dirty jobs. It's just how it has to be. But she did it this morning. You know, he woke up with a diaper full of poo this morning and she handled it. It's hard to extricate the overnight diaper. It's hard to extricate it perfectly and get it off him without any kind of mess. I'm worse at that. I'm not good at it.
So she's more delicate, more, I guess.
Better coordinated. I'm just a bumbler. I'll just bumble it and it'll be something horrific on the floor.
I will say I really don't get grossed out on fine changing poop diapers, but the 1 out of 50 times where you accidentally get a little on like your finger or something, I'm freaked out for the next half a day. I'm constantly washing and then smelling my hand and like being like, oh, I can still smell it.
It's a phantom poo. It's a phantom poo.
All right, Tom, you got one more and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. Who's the cleaner upper? Like dishes, cleaning up the toys.
Her more so than me. But I have my fiefdom. I mean, my fiefdom is I'm comfortable in the kitchen. So I like to. Like, I just have an idea of okay. I do this job. I have such a bad notion outside of that as to where everything goes. And I don't know if that's – I'm just bad visual spatial, but she has this intricate idea of where everything is supposed to go, especially among his items, and I just fail that test. Yeah. I fail it every time.
So I actually have one last question for you. It's not her dad or mom. It's something that Tom and I have spoken about a lot. I don't necessarily know if it's on the pod, but you and I have just spoken about it, Tom, which is – you're unlike Tom, this is still your first kid, right? And for the most part, like the development has all happened in front of your eyes, a lot of it during this COVID year, right? So I'm really curious, are you looking forward to going back on the road or are you actually going to miss being at home more?
That's a great question. I'm looking forward to being on the road every now and again. Just because you want the monotony of life broken up a little bit. And I think it's kind of good. I mean, this is a weird topic, but I've talked about a lot with Marcus Thompson. I think it's good for your relationship with your wife to do limited national level NBA travel. I think it's bad for your relationship with your wife to be a beat writer and to be always traveling. But just having every now and again a little trip and coming back, I think that's good. And I would think it would be similarly good for your relationship with your kid. I don't think Allie feels that way. Allie feels you stay here. We need you. Don't leave me alone. Not leave me alone with the gremlin. But that's my guess anyway. When things return to some normalcy.
Cool.
Well, we got a little bit of Radio Ethan, Ben, so mission accomplished.
We did.
It was half-assed. It was a half-assed Radio Ethan.
You know
what?
Next time you come back on, you'll be able to now that you got your muscle dusted off.
Yeah.
We also got a great deal of like CNN guest contributor on the real estate market. You know what I mean? Like that person who comes on who's not really an expert, but they make them feel an expert and like they talk like an expert.
Man, I just sold a house and bought a house. You know, there is some expertise. There is some expertise there.
Well, that's it, everybody. Thank you so much, Ethan Strauss, for joining us. Everybody, looking forward to more of these guests, and we're going to keep refining some of these segments. Great having you, Ethan. Thanks so much for letting everybody know.
Pablo.
If they're raising a surf, if they're raising a kid by the beach, they're probably going to become a criminal. So good to know.
Not a criminal, just a ne'er-do-well. You know, just your bottom line, basic ne'er-do-well. Thanks for having me on, guys. It was so fun to do this podcast. I know all podcasts are hashtag fun. I'm waving at my mom who just arrived. what's great about this is it's such a great change of pace. I don't have any good landing that I'm sticking because I'm blaming my mom. You distracted me. You know,
don't tell her about your bedtime story negligence. She's going to send you. All right. Ethan, thank you. Yes.